Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. It started out as a book about a classic American Western film. But as Glenn Frankel examined the story behind the film, what he found was a story that defined and challenged the foundational myths about the American West. The true story at the heart of John Ford's The Searchers reveals American fears, racism, and xenophobias, combined with our ideals of heroism, individualism, as well as our penchant for self-promotion. The true story told in Frankel's book, The Searchers, The Making of an American Legend, begins in 1836, the year of Texas independence, when 9-year-old Cynthia Ann Parker was abducted by Comanche Indians during a brutal raid in which most of her family were massacred. An uncle will spend years fruitlessly searching for his relative. Finally, 24 years later, as the wife of a warrior and mother of 3 Comanche children, including future chief Quanah Parker, she is, quote, rescued, unquote, by U.S. cavalry and Texas Rangers during a massacre on a Comanche village in which most of the members of her adopted Indian family are slain. Despite Cynthia Ann's later life of despair and obscurity, her story of abduction and recovery has become a powerful American myth, which is the basis for Ford's later motion picture, The Searchers. My guest today is Glenn Frankel, the author of The Searchers, Making of an American Legend, published by Bloomsbury. He's currently the director of the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin, but he's a former longtime Washington Post reporter, foreign correspondent, and editor, winner of the Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on the Middle East. He'll be participating in a BookSmart Tulsa event this evening, featuring a showing of John Ford's The Searchers and a talk later. It begins tonight at 7 o'clock at the Circle Cinema, and he joins us by phone. Glenn Frankel, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
Your book, The Searchers, you know, you hear that name, and it is a classic Western by John Ford, and as you write in the book, you were intrigued, repelled, fascinated by the movie when you first saw it as a kid. What brought this story back to you here in this day and age, after years as a foreign correspondent and reporter, and now back in Texas?
Well, I'd been with the Washington Post. I'd been overseas, as you said. When I came back to the States in 2006, I wanted to do an American book. And what was more quintessential, or what could be more than doing The Searchers? It's a movie I'd loved ever since I was a child. It had stuck with me. I'd gone back and read the novel. It seemed like a natural, and John Wayne and the director, John Ford. What I found out, though, when I first started looking into it, was that it was loosely based on a true story from Texas history. And so what began as kind of, you know, your standard, you know, making of the movie kind of book suddenly branched out, and suddenly I found myself researching 19th century Texas as well as 20th century Hollywood.
Yeah, and what initially attracted you to the film? I mean, because this is one of the darkest, I mean, in many ways it sort of predates the modern Western that we have today, where there are no guys in white hats and black hats. There, you know, everything's very ambiguous. This was one of the first movies that really took the Western in that direction.
Yes, it did. John Ford, you know, who was the great Western director of the 1940s and 50s, you know, by the time he makes The Searchers in 55, he's 61 years old. He's had a complicated life, and this is a mature work of someone who's given this a lot of thought. I don't know. When I first saw it, it just was so exciting. It was filmed in VistaVision. It was very colorful. It had the great John Wayne in probably his most charismatic role. And even the gunshot sound seemed a little more authentic to me. It was a very unsettling but very exciting film. And I should add, not just for me. I mean, Steven Spielberg, you know, watching it in Phoenix, Arizona as a boy, and Martin Scorsese in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and George Lucas in California, all of them have talked about what an influence this film had on them when they were young, and how, you know, and they quote from it in their own movies and they talk about it. I think it just, there's an entire generation out there that has a certain reverence for The Searchers, both because it's so powerful and so beautiful.
As you began researching it, you've discovered the story of Cynthia Ann Parker, who is the real-life, I guess, model for the person John Wayne is searching for in the film. Cynthia Ann Parker was abducted by the Comanches and spent 24 years with them.
That's right. She's living out in sort of the boundaries of East Texas, right, rubbing up against the area where Comanches and Kiowas and others sweep down to do their raiding. we're talking about 1836 now, a very important year in Texas history.
The year of the Alamo.
The year of Texas independence. And in May of 1836, after Texas has defeated the Mexicans, after Sam Houston's won the Battle of San Jacinto, Comanche swooped down on this settlement in East Texas. They kidnap Cynthia Ann, who's 9 years old, and four other young people. They kill five men, including her father and her grandfather, and they haul her off to Comancheria. The other four are ransomed back or rescued over the course of a couple of years. Her uncle searches for her over a 7 or 8 year period, but he never finds Cynthia Ann. And as you say, she spends 24 years with the Comanches. She marries a Comanche warrior. She has three Comanche children. And then one day in 1860, for the second time in her life, a group of armed men come down, swoop into her village, kill the people around her. And they're about to kill her when they notice that she has blue eyes. So they take her and her little baby daughter, who's with her at the time, and they haul her back to Texas and restore her to her white family. And she becomes kind of a mini celebrity for a while. You know, she's the white Comanche princess. But it's pretty clear pretty quickly that she's terribly unhappy to be back in Texas. She misses her two sons. She misses her husband. She misses that whole Comanche world. She has become a Comanche, and that's something that the Texans find very difficult to understand or accept. And eventually, this woman who was, as I say, kind of a celebrity for a while, they take her to the state legislature. Anyway, she's sent off to a family sawmill in East Texas, and we never hear from her again. There isn't even an obituary when she dies, and we're still not exactly sure. We think she died of typhus or some kind of fever passing through the area in the early 1870s. But she just goes off into obscurity.
Now, tell us a little bit about the Parker family, because the Parker family, relating this early history of the people who became the model for the searchers, this was a crazy family.
Well, it's a large family. I wouldn't call them crazy. Rich, I'd call them a sort of quintessential American family. I mean, they've been moving out west. They start off in Virginia. They work their way to Illinois and then to Texas. And inevitably what happens, because she has Comanche children and one of her Comanche sons survives, so there's a Comanche side to the family that exists to this day, and there's a white side to the family. And they don't meet for a long time, but one of the great parts of the story is to discover her surviving Comanche son, Quanah Parker,
yes,
who after the Comanche surrender becomes a sort of advocate of peace and reconciliation. And he goes down to Texas eventually and makes contact with the other side of the family. So you have this, as I say, you've got this American family, this white Texan family, and this Native American family, and they're still around. Next weekend in Cache, Oklahoma, not that far from Tulsa, there's going to be the annual Quanah Parker family reunion. They'll have their powwow in front of Quanah's old house, the Star House, and there'll be representatives from the Texan Parker family there, as well as a lot of folks from the Comanche side.
And it's interesting that I was not referring to her descendants, her older family, James Parker, and the people who actually went searching for him, because one brother of the Parker clan was kind of a missionary religious figure who really sort of was kicked out of every religion he was involved with. And then you had James Parker, who did the searching, and how many trips did he finance trying to find Cynthia Ann?
Oh, about a half dozen, and he's horribly unsuccessful. He writes a 90-page narrative of his perilous adventures. It's very self-serving, of course, and not very successful. He styles himself one of these great backwoodsmen who understands Indians, but in fact, he just doesn't understand them at all. And this is one of the things I found when I started looking into the old history of this. Every generation came along, starting with James, Uncle James in the 1830s and 40s, and each generation retells the story of Cynthia Ann and what happened at Parker's Ford and what it means, and they change it. They embroider bits and pieces here and there. They change it to fit their own needs and their own sensibility. And over time, the facts get lost, of course, in the mists of history. But what emerges is this kind of myth of who she was and what happened to her and what it means. And each generation sort of tells that story, as they say, until over time, you get this sort of making of a great American legend. Her own son, Quanah, the Comanche chief who surrenders in 1875 and becomes this kind of politician middleman who builds the Star House in Cache, Oklahoma, and befriends wealthy ranchers and even President Teddy Roosevelt, He tells the story of his mother to explain why he's a man of peace. His mother was a white woman. He's half white. That's Quanah's version of the legend, if you will, to explain why he becomes this kind of noble savage and reconciliatory figure. Each generation does it right up till the movie. The movie itself is another version of this story.
Well, how do you get to what the truth is? I mean, this is one of the things your book does. This is, okay, this is as best as we can figure probably what happened, because we really don't know because of all these contradicting accounts.
No, we really don't know. You know, I spent 35 years or so as a journalist for the Washington Post, and I've been a foreign correspondent and a reporter and an editor. I don't pretend that I've come up with a definitive version of what actually happened, because so much of it is lost in the past. What I've tried to do is find out some things that we know are true, try to separate, if you will, the facts that we can put together. I went back to the University of Texas Library and Archives, and I found, for example, some handwritten accounts by one of Cynthia Ann's cousins. She comes down to Texas in the late 1870s, and she interviews some of the people who knew her, family members, others, and she leaves notes. She was going to write a family history. She never publishes it. But I looked for sort of firsthand primary material that would get me as close in contact with who this woman really was and what she went through. And I try to sort out that from the stuff that's obviously not true. The time she was, cited over the years where they saw her with the Comanches. A lot of that is just, mythology. Because she herself left no narrative, of course. This allows the mythmakers to go, to run wild. They don't have to worry about the facts because there are so few facts. And, white historians do that in Texas. Comanches have their own oral legends of what happened. Everyone's entitled to their mythology, but what I tried to do was sort through that at least to get some of the basic facts we could rely on. And then, mine is not the definitive version. It's the version in 2013. Someone else will probably come along, next generation, do another one.
It was interesting. One of the things you do, you have to relate the history of the Comanche, the history of the settlement of Texas. And certainly the Texan-Comanche conflict was not singular in American history. This is a story that repeated itself as the country moved westward. But for a lot of people, this was perhaps one of the most violent and, there's something about the conflict between the Texans and Comanches that seems to be particularly vicious in both sides' way they treated each other. Why do you suppose that was?
Well, the Comanches living down there on the sort of high limestone plains in the panhandle, that's a tough life. And they were great horsemen. They were probably the early adapters of the horse and learned how to use horses both, to sort of supplement their buffalo economy and for warfare. And the Texans, they're pretty tough customers too. The Comanches run roughshod over the Mexicans and do a lot of raiding into Mexico. They do the same kind of raiding against the Texans, and they find they're up against, a slightly different creature. But you're right, this war went on for something like 40 years. It's the longest war on American soil. And it's not like two armies fighting on a battlefield, and occasionally a civilian gets accidentally killed. It's not that at all. This is a war of civilizations and where the families, the women and the children are not the sort of inadvertent collateral damage. They're the targets. And this isn't a war fought with drones, or you're not dropping bombs on people. People are looking you in the eye when they go to kill you. It is a very sort of intimate struggle involving families directly. And abductions, of course, were one of the fault lines and one of the things that really kept this war going. Because when your wife or your children are kidnapped and taken away from you, that makes this very personal. And so the personal nature of it and the hatred that was built up on both sides really makes it a devastating conflict, and one that only ends when one side totally crushes the other.
Yeah, it was interesting that you drew on your own experience as a foreign correspondent and understanding this conflict, because you said, when I'm reading about the Texans and Comanches, I'm thinking of my time in the Middle East, where women and children are oftentimes the combatants as well as the victims.
Yeah, that's right. I spent a long time in the Middle East. I was the Jerusalem bureau chief for the Washington Post. And there, too, you have two peoples, two nations, if you will, struggling over a piece of land and turning each other's families into the victims. Now, historical analogies can be really tricky, so I don't want to go too far with that. But Texas, this struggle was a real clash of civilizations. We talk about, say, Muslims and Jews and Christians having some sort of clash of civilization. Well, you know, maybe so, but they all worship the same God. They all share many of the same values, but Texans and Comanches shared nothing. They had a whole different concept of what people were, what the world was like, and so it's inevitable, and they're both warrior-like groups of people, so it's inevitable that their clash really was a true clash of civilizations. And one of Quanah Parker's gifts was his ability to help Comanches figure out how they were going to exist in this world, how after they'd been defeated, you know, in many ways it was more dangerous for them to become wards of the American state rather than enemies. He managed to navigate to get them through this really dangerous period when their whole way of life and their culture and their world were collapsing around them.
My guest today is Glenn Frankel. He's currently the director of the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin, a former longtime Washington Post reporter, foreign correspondent, and editor. His latest book is titled The Searchers, The Making of an American Legend. It's published by Bloomsbury, which actually began with the film, but actually went back to include this true episode that was the inspiration for The Searchers, this Cynthia Ann Parker, a Texan girl who was abducted by Comanches, raised as Comanche for all intents and purposes, became a part of the tribe before she was rescued during a battle some 24 years later, the mother of Comanche chief Quanah Parker, and became the basis for this first novel, then motion picture. Well, you mentioned it's very difficult to understand who Cynthia Ann Parker was, but one of the things that comes out is that she was a real wrench in the cogs of the how Texans perceive themselves and how they perceive the Comanche threat when she returned to white civilization.
Yeah, that's very true. They really didn't know what to do with her. Her family treated her as well as they could, but they couldn't understand why she wasn't grateful for being restored to a Christian world, you know, and redeemed from these savages. And so she becomes a bit of an embarrassment to everyone involved. You're not allowed, in a war like this, even though the Comanches are only maybe 100 miles from where her family's living, you know, outside of Fort Worth, she can't cross that border successfully. There's no way you go back and forth, because this is a war, and a war of populations, of families, and so she never gets to see her Comanche children or Comanche husband again. She really has a miserable time of it, and, you know, ultimately, she's the ultimate victim of this struggle. She's, as I said earlier, in 1836, she's wrested away from her family by a group of raiders, and then in 1860, it happens to her again. So she's not the hardy, you know, symbol of the romance of the plains that she was portrayed as at times back in history. She's the ultimate victim of this terrible war.
Well, as you're telling this story, I mean, you don't really have any firsthand accounts of her, but you have similar survivors who were abducted and lived life with a tribe. And for the most part, this was a very common experience, wasn't it?
Yeah, the Comanches abducted a couple of thousand people, most of them Mexicans, but also a good number of Texans as well. They needed people. First of all, their birth rate was low. Secondly, that horse-based buffalo economy required a lot of labor, both to keep up the horses and also to skin the buffalo, to preserve the meat, to do all the things they did with buffalo. And so raiding was part of their lives. Abductions were part of their culture. If you were young and a young person, this was a great life. They'd haul you off to Comancheria. They'd teach you how to ride and hunt. The girls had to work hard, of course, but you would often be adopted by a family that had lost a child. But if you were older than that, often you were treated as a slave or abused. If you were a man of a certain age, you would surely be murdered and often tortured for entertainment. It was a brutal way of life for some people, but the young people were quickly Indianized and adapted into the culture, and many of them found it very, very hard to return.
I found it interesting, it was just a line in your book, but trying to understand the brutality of the Comanche, and you said, look where they lived. They lived on the Llano Estacado, no water, no plentiful game. Everything they got was very hard took, and what they would do among themselves, it was a very loving relationship, but there was just no room for any outsiders in their area.
Yeah, I think that's true. The kinship ties were strong, and kinship ties meant everything to them. They relied on each other, but outsiders were fair game as far as they were concerned, and not to be trusted. And, you know, Texans had a somewhat similar attitude, obviously, about Native Americans, you know, so that the brutality that each side could show to the other was intense.
Well, in the book, you relate this whole story of this whole culture and, again, this unspoken fear of abduction, because you mentioned how the family reacted to her release. They were surprised she wasn't grateful after 24 years, and she's adopted an entirely new life, that she wasn't grateful for being, quote, rescued. And this was a very common theme, not only within the actual situations, but writers were writing about this. You know, James Fenimore Cooper, you write that, you know, the abduction scenario that became the basis of The Searchers was a big part of our earliest literature.
Yes, that's very true. I mean, I found out our first American bestseller was a book by a woman named Mary Rowlandson, who was kidnapped along with her three children in the 1670s and early 1680s by Narragansett Indians in New England. So the captivity narrative is our first American literary genre. James Fenimore Cooper, as you point out, almost every one of his novels has a sort of captivity narrative storyline or theme. This idea of, you know, barbarians, savages hauling off our women and children into the, you know, into the wilderness, into the savage wilderness. And then, you know, it had sort of psychosexual, you know, connotations, because if you were a young woman, would you be forced to have sex with Indians? That was considered a fate worse than death. And so this whole notion of that we have to fight against this, that this is the ultimate, you know, destructive impulse, and that it became justification really for conquering the West, for defeating the Indians, for killing them if necessary, for destroying their power, because otherwise they're threatening our women and children. And this is a theme running through the American frontier. You see it in the Cynthia Ann story. What's so fascinating about the movie is that John Ford, the director, takes these themes and raises them right to the surface. The uncle is searching for his niece in this movie, not so much to restore her to her family, but he resolves over time that he's going to kill her, because she's changed from being a young, you know, a little girl to being a young woman. She's become the wife of a Comanche. She's been forced to have sex with Indians, and now she's been polluted somehow, physically, spiritually, and he sees the only solution for this in killing her. And that's the narrative tension that makes the film so interesting and so compelling to watch.
Getting back to the age-old horrible practice of honor killing.
That's right, honor killing, which is very much a Middle Eastern phenomenon. You know, if your relative has been polluted or corrupted, you have no choice. The interesting thing in the movie, of course, is that the uncle is played by John Wayne. He's a very charismatic, powerful figure. We want him to succeed because it's John Wayne, after all. But look at the mission he's working on. Look at what he's planning to do. And the beauty of Wayne's performance is that he's clearly not happy, not comfortable. It's very hard for him to process this. He's a man of violence. He's a, you know, a frontiersman, an Indian fighter. But the idea, oh, I have the solution to this problem, I'll simply go and kill my niece, he's not happy about that. He's not comfortable with that. You see it in the performance, in the look in his expressions, in the way he walks. And so he's wrestling with these urges to restore her or to kill her. And it's very hard to know what he's planning to do.
Well, how does this story revive itself in the 1940s when Alan LeMay writes a novel, a fictionalized version of Cynthia Ann Parker?
Well, that's what happens. Alan LeMay was a Hollywood screenwriter, but he'd also written a number of Western novels. And actually, it's around 1950, he's up in the Texas Panhandle doing a Western, trying to be a director. And he hears the story of Quanah Parker and Cynthia Ann.
Of course, that's Quanah Parker country there in the
Texas.
That's
right. Yeah. Well, the Panhandle is really the heart of Comanche land, and so he heads down to East Texas. He interviews members of the Parker family, but he's interested in the uncle more than in Cynthia Ann. And the book he writes is about a fictionalized version of the uncle, and then a totally fictional second searcher, an adopted brother. And the two of them search for 7 years all over Oklahoma and Texas, trying to track down this little girl. And then, you know, some folks come along. The novel was pretty successful, did well, got good reviews. And then John Ford and his business partners come along, They buy the rights, and John Ford, who's the great maker of American Westerns, goes out to his favorite location, Monument Valley, takes his crew of wranglers and stuntmen and, you know, and movie actors, and his favorite movie actor, John Wayne, and they go and they shoot this fabulous movie.
The story has this good ending, which is that the Parker family today is very strong. In fact, I just met a relative here last night, a descendant of the Parker family. This is a, again, it is, there's just been this development of both sides of the family coming together.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, they hold separate family reunions each year. As I say, the one in Cache, Oklahoma, the Comanche one, is next Saturday. Then in July, there'll be a reunion of the White Parkers down there, you know, near Grosbeck, Texas, where the original raid occurred. Each side of the family, though, sends emissaries to the other for each reunion, and they have a silver bowl, an engraved silver bowl, that they trade back and forth each year. The Parkers in Texas are one of the first families of Texas. If you have ancestors, you can trace back to 1836, to the moment of independence, you get to be a first family. And they're very proud of their heritage, but they're also very proud of the Comanche side of the family. And they, too, you know, Rich, they're retelling the story, just like each generation has done. And they embellish it a little bit here and there. They have their own version that's come down in history. But this is a very proud moment for both families.
What has been the reaction of the both sides of the family to your book?
Very positive. I mean, you know, they're so proud of their ancestors. I think a lot of them are aware of the connection to the Searchers, but my book really makes it quite clear how all this came about. And, you know, I think both Cynthia Ann and Quanah are fascinating figures, very important and powerful, you know, parts of Texas history. So I think they're happy to see the publicity. They've been telling me when I've made little mistakes, you know, here and there about geography or this and that. I take thorough notes. When I get the paperback edition, I'll fix them all. So no one's hesitant to tell me the little bits I've done wrong, but I think they're both very proud of their ancestors and very proud to see the story told again.
Well, the name of the book is The Searchers, The Making of an American Legend. And this is a classic motion picture. If people haven't seen it or haven't seen it in a long time, it's worth taking a second look, because the acting performance of John Wayne is perhaps one of his best. Just this righteous anger that is a part of this story on both sides. The Comanche, I mean, the Comanche, you know, they were depicted as they were of the time, but there is this sort of nobility and sense of wrong that John Ford manages to communicate on both sides.
It's a very powerful film and a very unsettling film, because it challenges many of our assumptions about the Western. We're going to be showing it tonight. I'm going to talk about it for a bit ahead of time, and then we'll watch it at the Circle Cinema in Tulsa. And then afterwards, I'm going to stick around. And for anyone who wants to talk about John Ford and John Wayne, we'll talk some more.
All right. The name of the book, The Searchers, The Making of an American Legend. Glenn Frankel, thanks very much for your time.
Rich, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Glenn Frankel is a former Washington Post reporter, foreign correspondent, and editor, currently the director of the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin, and the author of The Searchers, The Making of an American Legend. It's published by Bloomsbury. He'll be participating in a BookSmart Tulsa event tonight featuring a showing of John Ford's The Searchers with a talk afterwards at 7 o'clock tonight at the Circle Cinema. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.